It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, it's maple syrup season. We'll find out how it's going, and you can join in with your own maple syrup experiences in the woods or in the kitchen. First, think about all the things at the grocery store you might see labeled all natural or organic or additive free. You might reach for those products thinking they're better for you. The idea that natural stuff is inherently better for us and or safer doesn't always match up with reality, though. It's something called the appeal to nature fallacy. The appeal to nature fallacy has shown up during the pandemic, too. The idea that natural immunity is better than the immunity you get from a vaccine is a common anti-vaccine argument. We're talking now with a behavioral scientist who wrote about this appeal to nature fallacy and how it affects public health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you prefer to buy natural products and foods? What does natural mean to you? Is there some benefit from it that you've pursued and think is definitely legit? Or do you think it's often a marketing gimmick? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Kelly Peters is CEO and co-founder of BE Works, a behavioral science think tank and a lecturer of applied behavioral science at the University of Toronto. Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I just gave kind of a broad definition of this appeal to nature fallacy. Can you give us some examples that we might encounter in our everyday lives?
Yeah, we regularly think that when something is natural, that it is all better. But I think that you actually nailed it when we called it out for what it is. Often it's a marketing gimmick. There isn't anything that is inherently better in something that's all natural. And yet that really goes against our intuition, doesn't it? Doesn't it just sound like something that's all natural? Doesn't it just sound like it has to be better? But in fact, that actually isn't true.
It could be, though. I mean, somebody might look and maybe do a little more research and say, okay, this product that says it's natural, I like because I know how it's produced. It doesn't use these particular pesticides I'm worried about or something like that. It isn't always necessarily wrong, right? It could go either way.
Yeah, there's an idea that if you understand what the ingredients of something are, then you're more protected against something that's unfamiliar that might actually be unhealthy for you. Our intuition around that, obviously that's common sense. But the thing is that many ingredients that we see in our foods and in our medicines, they're actually sometimes common ingredients, but they use a different terminology that seems very unfamiliar. And then that unfamiliarity seems scary. So this is this role of our emotions that are actually shaping our perception of the safety of an ingredient. And we're not actually looking at the chemistry and making a distinction in this case about what's healthy and unhealthy. And then often we have another bias, which is thinking that maybe we have the right knowledge and expertise to be able to make those decisions ourselves, rather than recognizing that there are experts and there are other processes that help to ensure the safety or harm in those products. So our own individual assessments are not necessarily accurate.
You wrote about this with a couple colleagues from the behavioral science world, and you refer to a 2015 experiment that found that people's preference for drugs labeled natural is so strong that even certain facts won't sway them. Can you tell us a little bit about that experiment?
This was one of the many ways that we've been trying to just understand the distinction that people will make and how far they will go just by changing the words that are used, labeling one drug with even the same output, the same effectiveness, but just changing how it's labeled, using the technical terms versus natural sounding terms, just changing the way that this is presented has an impact on people's perception of the safety and the effectiveness of a drug. And this is just swapping out different words. This study is actually interesting because even another study showed that when it comes to like adding ingredients in versus taking ingredients out could let us have a different assessment again, of the safety or quality of a product. I'll give you an example. There was a study looking at orange juice. Just do you add the pulp with the pulp added in or having the pulp removed? When you talk about orange juice having the pulp added in, that orange juice is actually labeled as or perceived as less natural than having pulp removed from an orange juice. So this in this case, what we see is that when we're adding a particular ingredient into something, it gives us this different perception of the naturalness of that particular product. So these are all of the different ways, again, that our intuition about what's natural and what's safe can misguide us.
Talking to Kelly Peters, behavioral scientist, looking at the idea that things are natural are automatically going to be better for us, an idea that often steers us wrong, she says. And Kelly, you and your colleagues are thinking about this now largely in terms of the pandemic and people's attitude toward vaccines. What are some of your concerns with the appeal to nature fallacy and how it might affect people's attitudes toward these vaccines that are rolling out?
Well, first of all, the epidemiological model suggests that we need to have around 85% of us on board with taking the vaccines in order for us to end the pandemic. So that is our collective and social goal in terms of what we need to achieve. And our research, along with research conducted by many others, reveals that about 10% of us are a hard no. They're not going to take the vaccine. Overall, we've got about a third of us that are on the fence. And when we look inside of that on the fence, a lot of folks are just saying, I'm going to wait and see. Looks like the vaccine was developed too fast. I want to understand what the side effects are. Or just frankly, the vaccines themselves seem scary. So that's a large group of people with whom their fears, their concerns, we need to understand. And we need to be able to address them. We need to make sure that not only is it about ending the pandemic and getting everyone on board for our society, but also it's our loved ones. If they don't take the vaccine, they continue to be at risk of being exposed to COVID-19 disease. So we want to figure out what are the biases that are getting in the way of their understanding of the positive impact the taking a vaccine will have on their health, as well as the health of us as a society. So those numbers were big. I told you 10% saying no, a third of people on the fence. So when we started to look at those reasons why, there was so much misinformation, so many different myths and misperceptions getting in the way. Answers already exist to the questions that people have, yet the biggest barrier that we face is not that the evidence isn't there for the safetiness of the vaccines. The evidence is there for the effectiveness of the vaccines. The biggest barrier that we face is misinformation and our own biases.
We're talking about the appeal to nature fallacy, the idea that things are inherently better or safer if they're labeled as natural. Kelly Peters is with us, CEO and co-founder of BE Works, a behavioral science think tank and a lecturer of applied behavioral science at the University of Toronto. Coming up, we'll look more at this idea of the appeal to nature and vaccine concerns. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that affects your own life? Do you have friends or family members who are worried about the vaccine? Have you heard the idea that natural immunity is going to be better than what we might get from a vaccine? We're going to talk about that coming up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with behavioral scientist Kelly Peters. We're looking at the idea that things that are natural are inherently better and or safer, and how that can get in the way of public health measures like, say, vaccinations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the topic and your questions. And Kelly, let's look at the notion head on now. This is what I think this piece you were working on with your colleagues really leads up to. some people looking at a vaccine, and I've heard this for flu vaccines, definitely we've heard it out there for COVID-19 vaccines, the idea that, no, I'm better off letting my natural immunity build up, not to the stuff I get from a vaccine. Could you talk about that idea and where you see it going wrong?
Yeah, now this is obviously where we need a medical expert to talk about how that works, because I don't have the medical credentials to explain the immune system, but neither do my friends on Facebook have that medical expertise either. So what I do is I look to what the top researchers and medical experts say, which is that our own immune system just will not have the strength to move fast enough and strong enough to combat the impact that COVID-19 would have on our system. Medical experts have done this analysis and have chosen the path that is best for us, which is to get the vaccine.
Well, and you write that maybe a rebranding in some ways is in order to talk about the vaccine. Instead of doing that, say the natural immune response enhanced by or triggered by the vaccine. Is something as simple as that, you think, something that would help the conversation?
I absolutely do. This is where understanding how we make decisions and the things that influence our shape, our perceptions, there's a whole science called behavior science, which understands these fears and the emotions that we have. And often that's what's missing. We've got the hard science and we've got policies that are being made, but no one's taking into consideration how we feel about these things. No one's taking into consideration our fears and our anxieties. And these things have a big impact in terms of our understanding the information that's being presented to us. So your idea of presenting the vaccines as, you know, giving them that label and using that bias that we have of natural makes us feel better. And so if we were to call these natural immune boosters, that's actually not a bad idea.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in Slinger. Nick, hi.
Oh, hi there.
What'd you want to bring up, Nick?
Well, I'm a public school teacher in Wisconsin here, living in Slinger, and I think my point is that terms like all natural are misleading, and also that you don't know they're misleading unless you have education. And we used to have an advertising unit where we even taught what words, thanks to organizations like the FDA, have meaning, like low fat, and some things really do carry weight. However, some, like all natural, totally meaningless. So again, just throwing out there the idea that education, support it. We're trying to do a job with these things that hopefully we don't have to have, public radio, thankfully, to show us those things or teach us about those things. So keep teaching about them. They need to be taught about.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. So Nick is teaching his students, Kelly, some, I guess you could call it consumer literacy on the kind of labels we're talking about.
Oh, well, first of all, thanks so much, Nick. We all appreciate the work that you're doing teaching the next generation. And I think a huge shout out to you for carrying the mantle on that, literacy. That's something that we've actually found and how important it is. In our research, one of the things that we did was we looked at how strong the science knowledge was of people. We asked them questions like, is an electron bigger or smaller than an atom? So we asked questions like that. But we also asked people questions like some math questions. If a pond is covered with lily pads that are doubling in size every day, and on the 30th day that lake is filled with lily pads, how many lily pads were in the lake on the 29th day? Now, some of you might be wondering, wait, how do I get the answer to that? But if it's doubling every day, then the day before it would be halfway covered. So those are really interesting kind of word puzzles that help us understand how people think when they're approached with different problems. And then last but not least, we looked at things like how critical people are when they're evaluating information. Do they use critical reasoning skills? What we found was that first category, that science knowledge, we found that was low with people that were highly skeptical about the vaccines. We found that the ability to use analytical reasoning to approach the word problems like the lily pads covering the lake, we found that people made a lot of mistakes when we gave them those kinds of problems. And then last but not least, when we asked them to do things like evaluate belief over evidence, they generally did quite poorly on those attributes. So these three things, the scientific knowledge that we have, the kind of analytical reasoning that we use, and our willingness to engage in critical thinking, all of those combine to make us more vulnerable to misinformation. And so what Nick is talking about in needing this kind of work in the classroom, over the past decade, teachers and schools having this in their curriculum continues to have to give way for other kinds of learning. But we would, our research would show that this is actually something that's contributing to the pandemic of misinformation that exists in our society. So understanding that all natural is a gimmick is the beginning of the kind of thing that we need to examine as a society.
Very briefly, as we wrap up, Kelly, do you think we need more behavioral science type thinking in our public health initiatives?
Absolutely. And I think that we all need more behavioral science. We all need to recognize the role that bias plays in shaping and perhaps leading us down the path of misinformation. Just remember, scientific thinking doesn't come naturally, and yet we need to work very hard to bring science into the way we understand the world.
We'll leave it there for now. Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Kelly Peters, CEO and co-founder of BEWorks, a behavioral science think tank and a lecturer of applied behavioral science at the University of Toronto. She joined us for a look at what's called the appeal to nature fallacy and how it could affect public health. More than 6,500 Wisconsinites have died from COVID-19 in the last year, but the heaviest toll has fallen on Native Americans, who are dying at the highest rate from the virus. Several weeks ago, Bad River tribal elder Joe Martin Rose died at the age of 85 because of complications from the virus. As Danielle Kading reports, Rose was a light in the lives of many within the Bad River community and beyond.
Joe Rose was the first person to welcome Patty Lowe to the Bad River community when she reconnected with the tribe 45 years ago. Lowe is a Bad River tribal member, but she grew up in Milwaukee.
He became like a second dad to me. Everything I learned about the Ojibwe, I learned from Joe.
Rose grew up on the reservation during a time of kerosene lamps, outhouses, and wood heat. He learned about plants and medicines from his grandfather, gaining an appreciation for the natural world. Lowe says that's something he passed on to all who knew him.
Good communities have a center, and Joe Rose was the center of Meshkezibi, Bad River.
Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins says Joe was an encyclopedia of knowledge about the history of the Anishinaabe people and their cultural practices. He taught people to live in a way that would benefit those for seven generations to come.
Joe was a compass point that always helped us remember our bearing. And from a community perspective, you know, all of our elders are real sacred because they give us those tangible ties to the past and help us remember where we came from.
Rose passed on his teachings to Bad River youth and through a Native American studies program that he led at Northland College in Ashland. That's where Mick Isham first met Joe as a student more than 30 years ago.
That guy saved my life, and I'll never forget it, because I swear I don't know where I'd be without him.
Isham, whose dad is Native and mom is white, remembers struggling with his identity. It was also around the time protesters gathered at boat landings to hurl insults and rocks at tribal spearfishers seeking to defend their federal treaty rights.
I couldn't figure out how they were not throwing punches and things like that. And Joel explained to me, basically with a European proverb, you catch more flies with, what is it, honey than vinegar or something like that. And when they go low, you go high.
Joe would defend those rights and the natural resources on which they relied throughout his life. During a contentious debate over iron mining, he and other tribal members traveled to the state capitol in 2012. He, along with drummers from Bad River, protested a Republican bill that weakened environmental standards and sought to pave the way for a more than $1 billion iron ore mine proposed upstream from the Bad River Reservation.
We can't put any price on the wild rice or any of those other resources that a hunter-gatherer society would use. So this mine is not going to happen. I don't plan on losing this one.
Former Democratic State Senator Bob Jouk says that's when he first got to know Joe, who invited him and his Republican colleagues to Rose's Roundhouse on the reservation.
He really left us with an indelible impression of the many years of mistreatment of the Native American people to allow us to feel captivated by a sense of what their life has been like.
Lowe says Joe was a fighter and a pillar of strength. When he first contracted the virus, she says he got better before taking a turn for the worse. Losing someone to the disease is always heartbreaking, but she says it hits tribal communities even harder.
To lose those elders who can speak the language and know all the truths embedded in that language is so devastating.
Bad River tribal member Dylan Jennings says many are still in shock, but he knows Joe would be proud to see community members continuing his legacy.
He's made a huge enough impact to where his memory lives on through our language being revitalized and our cultural way of life and our ceremonies being revitalized and still being carried forward.
So that those teachings will live on for the next seven generations. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can find more coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic here in Wisconsin online over at WPR.org or using the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Coming up after the news, a look at a longtime Wisconsin tradition on this week's edition of Food Friday. It's maple syrup tapping season. We'll follow syrup from the tree to the table, and you could join in with your own experiences out in the woods or at the kitchen table. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7 on The Morning Show, a Republican state lawmaker shares new bills that would change voting laws in Wisconsin, including changes to early voting and mail-in ballots. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now it's maple syrup sugaring season. It takes gallons of sap from a maple tree to make a bottle of the maple syrup you have in your fridge. We're in the midst of syrup season in Wisconsin, so we're going to talk about how maple syrup is made. How does sap in a tree get turned into the stuff you pour on your pancakes? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you ever harvested and made maple syrup yourself? Are you doing it right now? Do you have advice for people who might like to try? And what is your favorite way to eat maple syrup? Do you have any recipes with it that you like to make? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Casey Tate joins us for this week's edition of Food Friday, curriculum and instruction manager at River Edge Nature Center in Saukville. Casey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me to be here. It's a pleasure.
Casey, before we get into maple syrup, tell us a little bit about the River Edge Nature Center and what you do there apart from the maple syrup.
Sure. River Edge Nature Center has been a nature center located in Saukville, Wisconsin. We've been around since 1968, so we just celebrated our 50th anniversary a couple years ago. And it's from its inception, it's been a nature center focused on educating people around Southeast Wisconsin about the natural world. I've been there for about 2.5 years. I'm the curriculum and instruction manager, so I teach a lot of classes. I help write curriculum for some of the programs that we do here at River Edge. So we have a lot to offer. We have family programs. We have started a charter school this year, so it's K through 5th, with kids coming here every single day. School programs, homeschool programs, there's a lot going on. So it's been a really exciting season, and now with maple sugaring going on, it's gotten just a little bit busier, but in a good way.
Yeah, you do a lot of maple syrup. Can you talk about what's going on there?
Yeah, so now we've been tapping our trees since the very end of February. We tap up around 400 trees at River Edge. And so this is a longstanding tradition that we've had. We've been doing it since we started. And so we'll tap about 100 trees with some of our students. And we make a lot of maple syrup that we sell in our gift shop and to local areas. And yeah, it's a great opportunity for people to learn about this longstanding tradition that's been done by people in Wisconsin for lots of years.
Yeah, can you talk about what it's like for that the first timer, maybe that kid who's working on the process from the tree to boiling it down and more? What kind of things do they learn along the way?
Yeah, I think one of the most surprising things to learn, especially for kids, a lot of kids, unfortunately, they have a disconnection where their food comes from. You know, you ask them where maple syrup comes from and they say the grocery store, you know, to connect them to the idea that it comes from a tree and the process that it takes to go about collecting it. So when a kid comes to River Edge, we take them through some of the traditions going back to, you know, Native American traditions with the Ojibwe and Potawatomi of the area, going on to how pioneers changed some of those practices, and then moving on to our modern practices today, and they learn how to tap into a tree. They learn how long it takes to turn that sap into syrup. We make some tools by hand that they can take home with them so that if they want to tap at their house, they're able to use some of those tools. And really get a sense of some of the, and then of course they get to try some syrup. And years past, where they had, we've been able to do pancakes with our syrup. This year, they're just getting a taste of syrup, kind of in their own special way. We sometimes give out little prepackaged candies, but they still get to taste that little bit of sweetness for spring.
And now I saw you give away those kits, and you also, I think, in your gift shop, sell some home kits. I think you call them micro maple syrup kits. Now, I've got a couple maple trees out there. I don't know, do they all produce the sap I can make maple syrup out of? Can I walk up to any maple and start the process?
Yeah. So, I mean, all trees have sap, right? But sugar maples are really the tree that you want to be looking for. You can tap other maple trees. There are other species of maple trees like red maples, Norway maples, black maples. There's even other kinds of trees that have been known that people have collected sap to make syrup with, in particular birch trees, basswood, hickory, sycamore. But sugar maples are what you're looking for because they are renowned for the highest amount of sugar in their sap. So even though 3% doesn't seem like much, it's usually around maybe 2%, maybe up to 3%. It's far higher than any other kind of tree. So by tapping a sugar maple, you're saving yourself a little bit of time and work in converting that sap into syrup.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about maple syrup with Casey Tate from River Edge Nature Center in Saukville. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Michael is with us in Kaukauna. Michael, hi.
Hey, thank you for being there. I appreciate it. It's a wonderful subject. It's been in my family for about four generations, and there is no poor use for maple syrup in a sweetening world. One of our favorites is vanilla ice cream with maple syrup on it rather than chocolate. But any place you use a sweetener, your breakfast cereal in the morning, your unsweetened cereal that's better for you, like a good bran cereal, just a little bit of maple syrup on it is just better than anything else in the world. So any place you'd use sugar or another sweetener, use syrup. It's a great, great thing. So thank you so much for your show.
Oh, hang on, Michael. I want to ask you. So I've had maple as a glaze on pork and some other things. You've been in maple syrup a long time. Is there anything you like to cook with it?
you don't tell my dad this, but I used to make beer, and I used it as part of an antigen in beer.
Ooh.
But instead of using, you can use honey or other things to change the flavor. You don't change the maple. You don't taste the maple in the beer. Anytime you cook with maple and you increase heat, like people try to make cookies with it, the maple flavor doesn't come through. So it's best straight up being used, like you say, in a maple glaze, but even that, it can lose its flavor. So that's why it's just better on any kind of unsweetened cereal, ice cream, or any place you'd use sugar. It's better for you. Excellent. It's more digestible, and it adds a wonderful flavor that's above and beyond, you know, pure sugar.
Michael, thank you so much for sharing your experiences there. Casey, do you have a favorite way to consume maple sugar, traditional or a little more unusual?
Yeah, so here at River Edge, we actually have a funny tradition. We, of course, we cook up those pancakes and we put maple syrup with it, but we also have a little side of pancake on there. And I don't know exactly where this originates. I think it might be related to some of the German immigrants of the area. But you wouldn't think that the two flavors would mix necessarily, you know, kind of sweet and sour, but it works, and it's actually surprisingly really good. And going along with what Michael said, he was talking about some of those health benefits, and that's true. You know, compared to some of those other sugars that you might find, maple sugar in particular, or maple syrup, has a high amount of zinc, it has manganese, it has potassium, thiamine, iron, calcium, and it's got these nutrients in there that you might not find in some other sugars that you use in your cooking.
Interesting. And that sweet and sour, I have a beverage I like that includes lemon and maple and a potent third ingredient. And the lemon and maple works really well together.
Oh, yeah. I have not tried that, but I'm very curious now.
It's a surprise to me. Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Robert is with us in Amherst Junction. Robert, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm sitting here boiling right now. up on my garden, I've got a pan steaming like crazy, and it's not maple sap, it's box elder sap.
Oh, so what does that end up? Is that sweet like maple?
Yes, box elder is in the maple family, and for over 20 years, you know, I don't have any maple trees, but I have a ton of box elder trees around this old retired dairy farm, and I tap them, and I make syrup every year.
Interesting. Robert, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Casey, do you just actually tap the actual sugar maples at River Edge, or do you diversify a little bit like Robert does?
Yeah, and he's right. You know, you can tap other trees that are, every tree has a little bit of its own distinct flavor. So we have mainly tapped sugar maples here. However, I know in the past we have tapped birch trees as well. And so that's another common option as an alternative to sugar maples.
Thanks a lot for the call, Robert. Gary joins us next in Brookfield. Gary, hi.
Hello. I'm boiling sap also right now, and I boil it on my 3-burner camping stove. My question is, at what point should I boil it to 219, 218? I've been doing it for 4 years, and if you don't watch it, it boils over, and you don't have any maple syrup, by the way.
Oh, no. Gary, thanks for the call. I don't know if you have that specific level of advice. Casey, any thoughts?
Yeah, so 219 is kind of that magic number where you're supposed to take it off. It can be tricky because you don't want it to go too much over that. So usually for us, you know, here at River Edge, or if you're cooking at home, you really want to watch that temperature. And even before it gets to 219, as it gets to 216, 217 degrees Fahrenheit, you might want to transfer it to a smaller pan, or continue cooking over the kitchen stove where you can more monitor that temperature. And you can also add a little bit of butter or cream, which can keep the boiling syrup from bubbling over. So those are my recommendations. Yeah, it is a tricky measurement, but there's a couple things to help.
Gary, hope that helps. Now, this is pretty precise temperature measurement, Casey. What am I using to monitor my temperature with here?
Yeah, so if you want to be exact, we do recommend using more of a candy thermometer, which you can get from various different places. And so the sap boiling temperature, when the sap boils, it boils at a higher temperature than the water boils. So you really want to get it to right around 219 degrees. There are some more non-exact ways to do it. There's something called the blob test, where basically you take a spoonful of the boiling fluid and you dip it into a bowl of cold water. And if it forms a blob and then sinks to the bottom, you know that you've created that syrup. So it's kind of a non-exact form of way of doing it, but it still works.
I like the name, too, the blob test. It is Food Friday. We're talking about maple syrup. Casey Tate is with us, instructor at River Edge Nature Center in Saukville. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your maple syrup experiences if you've tapped and processed maple syrup in the past or right now, or your favorite ways to cook and or eat with it. 800-642-1234 is the number. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with River Edge Nature Center instructor Casey Tate. She's telling us about maple syrup, how it goes from tree sap to a delicious breakfast or lunch or dinner treat or drink. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Sharon is with us in Willard. Sharon, hi.
Hi. I take a venison roast and I liberally sprinkle Chinese five spice on or any other hot pepper like cayenne or anything. And then I slow cook that. And then towards the end, like the last half hour to an hour, I'll put maple syrup on top. So you have the spicy venison with your maple syrup. So it offsets the heat. But you can do any cut of meat you want. You could cube it and do the same thing, and you have the same result.
And Sharon, you're just adding the maple syrup in the last, you said, half hour to an hour, so it doesn't cook too long and it doesn't lose that maply flavor. You still taste the maple?
So it doesn't burn on the bottom of the pan.
Oh, that too. That makes sense. Sharon, thanks a lot. That sounds delicious. Maple syrup and venison, Casey, bringing together a couple of Wisconsin traditions there.
That's right, yeah. I haven't heard of that, but it sounds amazing.
Yeah, do you and your colleagues there experiment with glazes for grilling with maple syrup, or does it all get used up for the breakfast type foods?
We use it mainly for our breakfast, and also for we sell it here at our gift shop, and we also make sap tea for some of our special events and whatnot. But we don't do a lot of cooking experimentation here at River Edge. And now I'm just writing down some of these ideas that some of you are calling. Probably going to try some of them out a little bit later.
Yeah, sounds really good. Back to your calls now. Thank you, Sharon. Sarah joins us next in Trumbull County. Sarah, hello.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment. My husband's in the mix of cooking the sap right now. And he's been doing it for several years. And this year he made a reverse osmosis. And it has drastically cut down the cooking amount of time to get it to the right 218 degrees. And I just wanted to say that if you ever have time to make one or even purchase one, it does benefit the cooking process.
Interesting, Sarah. Thanks a lot. I've never heard of that reverse osmosis sap processing, Casey.
Yes, I have heard of that. There are lots of unique processes to sort of cook the sugar or bring or cook the sap, I should say, or bring out even to bring out the sap from the tree. And the process has changed over time, as you might imagine. And the really interesting thing is that's sort of what is happening within the tree. There's sort of this high pressure built up inside of the tree, and as you cut into it, it's drawing out that sap into the low pressure air surrounding it.
Thanks a lot for that call and the idea. Danny joins us next in Muskego. Danny, hi.
Hi. I've been doing home maple syrup making for a number of years. I had four trees. Now I've got three, but they're pretty good size ones. I've been having difficulty with filtering because it seems like when I use the pre-filters or cheesecloth or coffee filters. It doesn't really, you know, and I can get it through and it'll look perfectly clear. And then if I put it in bottles and then boil it in for, you know, for sterilizing, whatever, for long-term storage, it then still gets the sand in it that goes mostly to the bottom. And, I mean, as far as getting it to syrup, by the way, the best thing that I've found for finding the moment of it is to use a hydrometer, which I will do even though I'm only boiling off maybe three, four. I'm finally getting three or four cups of syrup per time that I do the boiling. Because then you can get it right on. And, you know, I double check it with the sheeting off the spoon test, and it's like much more reliable than the thermometer method that I was using. And I was even using two thermometers at a time, and it just, I was missing the syrup point until I got the hygrometer.
Danny, thanks a lot for sharing that. But Danny's question about filtering, any thoughts for her, Casey?
Yeah, so it's very common for sugar sand to occur as you're going through that filtering process. And really you want to look at the temperature of the product when you're filtering it. You know, you don't want your finished product to look cloudy or hazy. So you really want, when you're filtering, you want that temperature to be around 180 to 190 degrees Fahrenheit. Because if your syrup is hotter than that, it can, when it passes through the filter, you can have more buildup of that sugar sand, and you might have to refilter it. So the hygrometer might work, definitely works, but also the temperature as you're filtering.
Thanks a lot. Hope that helps. We're talking to Casey Tate from the River Edge Nature Center in Saukville, talking about maple syrup season, processing maple syrup and or eating it. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. We've got Linda with us in Madison. Linda, hi.
Hi. I've tapped a black walnut tree and got a couple cups of syrup and then cooked it down in the house, which turns out not to be a very good idea because you just have water just coming down the windows and the walls. And it ended up with syrup that tasted quite good.
Interesting.
And then after that, since I didn't want to do that cooking it down anymore, I and my neighbors, we just used it for making coffee and tea, and it just made it a little sweeter and
interesting.
It was good.
Linda, thanks a lot for that. I've never heard of black walnuts. As you say, all trees have sap.
Trees
have you heard
sap.
Of people using that, though, Casey?
Yeah, I've made ink with black walnut, mostly, you know, from the nuts and, you know, the different processes. But, all trees have sap, so you can definitely make it from a black walnut. Like I said, the sugar maple has the highest amount of sugar, so it takes a little bit less effort. But as, you know, many trees have different properties, you can get different flavors. So I'm very curious to know what black walnut syrup tastes like.
Thanks a lot for that call, Linda. Well, Casey, obviously our listeners have a lot of expertise in doing this. For somebody who's more like me, though, if I said, okay, I'm going to try to tap and process maple syrup in my own home, how big a chore is this really?
You know, it's a little bit of a chore, but the sweet product at the end, you know, makes it worth it. Like you had mentioned at the very beginning, it takes quite a lot of sap to make a little bit of syrup. Usually it's, if you have about 2% sugar in your sap, it can take about 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup. So it takes quite a lot of cooking. And like the last caller mentioned, you probably want to do that cooking outside. You're going to make a lot of steam that's going to go up into your kitchen. So if you have an outdoor grill or a fire that you can make outside, that's going to help. And, you know, if you're new to this, it's quite, you know, you don't need as many huge expensive tools as you might imagine. Here at River Edge, this year we've actually been selling micro tapping kits or micro sugaring kits. And it comes with a bag, it comes with a cover, it comes
comes with a spile and sort of a guide to help you get introduced into this whole process, what's happening, when to tap, and when to do what. And so it's really been quite popular this year as everyone's learning a lot of new skills in quarantine and, you know, learning a lot of self-reliance skills, and it's been really great. So, yeah, there's not a whole lot that you need. It just takes a bit to cook it all down.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Casey Tate from the River Edge Nature Center in Saukville. Keep sharing your maple syrup stories on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday, there's been controversy in state government hearings when it comes to masks and the ability to join in remotely over health concerns. An open government advocate tells us more. That and more coming up Monday on Central Time. Yesterday on the show, we talked about classic movies and asked you to share some of the movies that are classics for you. We heard from a lot of you with great suggestions, and we didn't have time to get to all of your emailed movie ideas. Here are a few of your classic movies. Virginia in Madison emailed us to bring up Disney's Fantasia. She says, an art film using animation, it was a stunner. Dale suggests How Green Was My Valley and The Long Gray Line. And Matt emailed us to recommend Breakfast Club and Shawshank Redemption. So a lot of good weekend movies there for you. I also surveyed Central Time producers. I heard back from a few. Dean Canetter says A Paper Moon, and he follows it up with one that I hadn't heard of, The Cranes Are Flying. Look what that's all about. Jay Carlisle Larson first asked if Independence Day was a classic yet, and then just says, yeah, Independence Day. Colleen Leahy recommends It Takes Two, part of the Olsen Twins canon. Bill Martins didn't officially reply, but I'm going to put him down for Home Alone or Uncle Buck. I don't know if they're really his top classics, but he refers to them often. Or maybe Kindergarten Cop. I'll throw that out there, too. That's more of an in-joke here at WPR. I don't know if that's really on his list. Still time for you to tell us about your favorite movie classics. You could do that on Twitter. At Central Time WPR is where to find us and message us on Twitter. Again, that's at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.